KFFradio.org or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, another farm bill extension has expired. Now what? It's the second straight year Congress has failed to pass the typically five-year piece of legislation, which for almost a century has underpinned the U.S. agricultural sector and food aid programs. Rosie Starr speaks to one local farmer about the impact of these extensions. Plus, a local effort from teens and children in 4-H to help victims of hurricane relief in the Carolinas and beyond. The Sullivan County Diversity and Youth Committee's Sullivan Rock the Vote concert is this Saturday. We'll hear from two of the performers. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi has a profile of an author with a new play called Canoza Lake. It's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Health officials in Gaza say four people were killed and dozens of others were injured after Israel carried out an attack on a hospital turned shelter for displaced Palestinians. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalti reports first responders say this is the seventh time the shelter has been struck since the start of the war.
Videos filmed by witnesses at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir el-Balah showed huge flames rising from the yard as fire ripped through tents sheltering thousands of displaced Palestinians. The Israeli military said it was targeting a Hamas command and control center operating inside the hospital. It said it had used, quote, precise munitions to mitigate harming civilians. Muhammad Wadi is displaced in the hospital with her family. She told NPR's Gaza producer Enes Baba she was still in a state of shock. I found the tent blazing with fire, she said. I woke up to pick up my daughters to rescue them. The UN agency responsible for Palestinian refugee affairs called it, quote, another night of horror. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Israel has been ramping up its military offensive in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah targets. The UN on Sunday said Israeli tanks had broken through the gates of a base of its peacekeeping force, wounding two of its members. NPR's Ada Peralta reports it's the latest accusation of Israeli violations and attacks, which have been condemned by its own allies.
The UN says Israel has also fired at their positions on other occasions. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he regrets the incidents, but that the way to prevent them in the future is to, quote, move the UN troops out. The UN says that they're not leaving because this is their job, to keep the peace in this volatile region.
That's NPR's Ada Peralta reporting. Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning as China said it's exploring new ways to stimulate the world's second largest economy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 19 points in early trading.
Stocks rose more than 2% in Shanghai, while Hong Kong's index finished lower. Tokyo's market was closed for a holiday, as is the bond market here in the United States. China's finance minister says that country's government is looking for new ways to boost the Chinese economy. Many investors worry that existing stimulus measures have fallen short. The Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded today to a trio of U.S.-based researchers who study the ways national institutions help make some countries richer than others, Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson at MIT, and James Robinson at the University of Chicago will share the prize worth 11 million Swedish kroner, or just over 1 million U.S. dollars. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 12 points. This is NPR News in Washington. Many Native Americans are marking Indigenous Peoples Day in the U.S. A number of events will be held across the country today, including a voting rally in Minneapolis and a discussion about the Native vote at Virginia Tech. The holiday comes 3 weeks before the November election. More than 4,000 square miles of ocean are getting new protections from the Biden administration. NPR's Lauren Sommer reports a new national marine sanctuary off California is the first to be led by indigenous groups.
The rugged coastline of Central California is home to a rich array of marine life. It's also where many sacred sites are for the Northern Chumash tribe. A decade ago, they nominated the area to get federal protection. Now the Biden administration is designating the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. That means the waters will be protected from oil drilling and its ecosystem will be monitored. The sanctuary will also be managed in partnership with local indigenous groups, part of a growing movement to give tribes a say over the land and waters that once were theirs. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
Schools and many businesses are closed on Sri Lanka today. The nation's disaster management agency says torrential rain over the weekend has flooded the island, leaving at least three people dead. The center says floods have damaged more than 200 homes and forced thousands of people to evacuate. Authorities have cut electricity in some areas as a precaution. The military has been deployed to help with search and rescue efforts and food distribution. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their travel card, Venture. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Farm Bill is a five-year omnibus that supports a staggering array of federal agriculture and nutrition programs. The 2018 version of the Farm Bill was extended last November, but now that extension has expired without a clear idea of when Congress will pass a new Farm Bill. The House bill passed committee in May, but has not come up for a vote on the full floor. The Senate version of the bill is still in committee. Republican U.S. Representative Mark Molinaro of New York's 19th District told Spectrum News, quote, "We're hopeful that before the end of the year, we can get the farm bill done in both the House and the Senate," end quote. The farm bill is crucial for many farmers. Farm and Country's Rosie Starr spoke to Brett Habig of Two Creeks Farm, a 100-acre organic regenerative farm in the hills of northeast Pennsylvania.
Brent, where are we now in the 2023 Farm Bill?
Well, we're pretty much living with the 2018 Farm Bill that should have been renewed in 2023. It's been extended through continuing resolutions, and getting that updated appears to be a murky process. There have been some steps forward. The House Ag Committee has drafted a 2023 Farm Bill that has been approved by the House Ag Committee, but not by the larger House. So there's still many steps for that to progress, but at least there's kind of an initial revision of the Farm Bill that has been put to paper by the House Ag Committee. But there's many steps before that's fully negotiated and put into law. And I expect that won't happen until what would be calendar 2025, until next year.
And by then we'll have a new president. You just returned from Washington. Let's talk about your experience getting there. Did you go to Washington with the intent of addressing the Farm Bill?
Yeah. So a group called Americans for Family Farms has been active in lobbying for the Farm Bill to better support small and medium scale U.S. farmers. And I had participated in some letter writing with them. I had organized a fly-in for farmers throughout the United States. So I was invited to participate in that fly-in. So that fly-in had about 30 to 40 participating farmers, and we met with a whole set of either congressional or Senate offices, mainly their ag staff, to discuss our perspectives on the Farm Bill and to debate what was in fact in the best interests of small family farms within each state. So we had a whole set of meetings. I met with three or four of the congresspeople on the PA side, and as well as senators. I met with Fetterman's office. We did not meet with Senator Casey's office. We were focused on what they call the EATS Act. It's a pretty dramatic acronym. It's called Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression. And this is a provision that has been written in to the farm bill that has been approved by the House Ag Committee. And the EATS Act essentially takes away states' powers to govern their own agricultural policies. And this was something that, as small farmers, we were vehemently opposing. So the context for that actually had to do with pigs and hog farming. And it all started in California, where California had a referendum on whether or not hog farmers could be caged during gestation or during the period of pregnancy. And they would be caged in most industrial pork farms in a way that they're unable to turn around for the entire period that they're pregnant, which is just very difficult animal welfare. So California had voted by referendum to prohibit that for any pork produced in California or sold into California. And that was overwhelmingly voted for by the California citizens, that they did not want gestation crates in California pork. But that was very unattractive to big pork producers that just want to sell whatever they want into California. That went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld the decision in California, and now that's become the EATS Act that's in the House version of the Farm Bill, where they're basically trying to overturn what California had done to advance animal welfare. And they're taking that a step further and saying no state can determine its own agricultural trade policies. So no state could set standards about what agricultural products would be allowed into that state. Now, we feel as small farmers that's very bad for us because there's a lot of niche market opportunities, and we want states to have the full authority to support farmers within their own states. And if everything is determined federally, we don't think that that's good for small farmers. But it is good for big business, because if the EATS Act is passed, then basically big ag really only needs to lobby in Washington. They don't have to worry about states. But in any case, I know it's a lot of detail there, but the bottom line is we were trying to support states' rights to be able to determine their own agricultural policies, which is really important to promoting local food throughout the U.S.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Because each state has a different geography, a different climate, different consumption.
So from a farmer perspective, it was very obvious to all of us that this was not helpful. The other side of this argument is big ag, big pork. They want to be able to sell into every state without worrying about any state-specific legislation that complicates their production, sales, or marketing. It's national or global pork producers. This is a complicating factor to their business. But most small farmers are selling locally anyway. And things like Prop 12 in California, Massachusetts has similar legislation also voted by referendum. It's called Question 3. It's the identical thing in Massachusetts. And states being able to advance policies that promote not only local farmers, but also animal welfare standards that their populations believe should be the basis for our agricultural law. I don't see any benefit to taking that away, aside from the big producers that just want to be able to basically sell into any state with ease. So if this were to pass, what it means is that basically all that the big ag or four major pork producers that dominate the market, they don't have to worry about states anymore. They just have to capture Washington, and then they have the policies they want. For us, Pennsylvania has its own farm bill. Pennsylvania has a program called PA Preferred. If the EATS Act were passed, the implications for the farm bill or PA Preferred are anywhere from murky to extremely negative. It's unclear sort of what Pennsylvania's authority is to determine a lot of its own agricultural policies. So again, for us, for myself as a Pennsylvania hog farm. We're a diversified farm, but hogs is a part of our farming. We want to be able to work in a state where small farming in general is working well. Pennsylvania has one of the most healthy local food systems of any state anywhere. We don't want that to be in any way complicated by Pennsylvania's ability to determine its own agricultural policies. And it's the same for New York, or you fill in the blanks. As you're saying, each state is very, very different, and their ability to set their own standards, determine their own policies, I think is very important for small farmers within those states.
Talk about the process a little bit, about what it's like to go to Washington and do what you just did. Everyone, all the farmers, do they get up individually and get a chance to literally speak and have a certain amount of time to present?
Yeah, so we in general group by state. So if we were at Senator Fetterman's office, we would have PA farmers, or when we were at Congressman Cartwright's office, we would have obviously myself within District 8. You know, we would try to have the farmers as much as possible as constituents to those lawmakers, because then our voice is obviously that much more important. So it would be small groups of farmers meeting with then a set of staffers within those offices. And we would basically say what we're here to do. We're here to oppose the EATS Act. And then we would go around, and each of which would talk about what the EATS Act means for our own farms and why we think it's harmful. The most incredible thing that was just mind-boggling was uniformly the answer that we got from the congressional staff was, well, you know what? We just had farmers in last week, and they told us the opposite thing. And we're really confused, because you say you're farmers, and they say they're farmers, but you're both telling us the opposite conclusion.
And are they both Pennsylvania farmers?
I don't know who those other farmers were, but the point is the lobbying of the large companies to represent their interests through credible voices of small farmers is very powerful, such that we're really dealing with enormous confusion. So like they would say, what you're saying makes complete sense, but we had just heard from farmers who said the exact opposite thing yesterday.
Well, that's good that they clarify that with you. And perhaps it's just about pure competition, that what's going on, the lobbying.
Right. But we're not in a position as small farmers to have boots on the ground lobbying in Washington on a parallel scale of the largest agribusinesses on the planet. And I think that's the asymmetry that makes this difficult. I was surprised. I think we were taken very seriously. They were very appreciative. They understand farmers are busy. They were very appreciative that we were all there, that we were sharing our perspectives. I think they could see that our arguments were solid. They typically didn't have great counter arguments. It's almost like we were both saying the same thing. This is better for small farmers to have this. This is better for small farmers to not have this. So it'd be like if I came in here yesterday and we had the entire opposite interview, and then you're trying to edit this and you're like, what's going on here? So it's that level of confusion and distortion of sort of the farmer's perspective that I think is going on. Now, we also had some representatives' offices who clearly were supporting the EATS Act and were just giving us FaceTime, because we could see when we were just talking and they were just yesing, and then quite quickly they were like, thank you very much. And then they were, we appreciate your time. And then we'd be right out of that door in 15 minutes. Most of the meetings were in depth, and they were really trying to understand the pros and cons of this legislation. And basically our point was, take it out of the farm bill. The farm bill has enough going on in it. Take this out. It's not going to help anyone. It's a lightning rod issue. If farmers don't believe it's helping, the farm bill will be harder to pass if this is in it. So So take it out and focus on the rest of all the difficulty that we have ahead of us to get this farm bill passed.
That was Wayne County farmer Brent Habig speaking on the topic of the EATS Act, which stands for Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression. Located in Northeast Pennsylvania, Two Creek farm practices include no-till gardening, silvopasture-grazed livestock and poultry, and woodland-foraged pigs. More information is available online at twocreek.net.
And that's Farm and Country's Rosie Starr speaking to Brent Habig. Thank you for that report, Rosie. And also be sure to tune into Farm and Country Saturdays at 10 a.m. here on Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear from the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau about a few stories, including Attorney General James suing a Sullivan County mobile home park for years of dangerous conditions. This is Radio Catskill.
It's going to be a big election year. Registered voters in Sullivan County can vote early at the Government Center in Monticello or the Public Health Office in Liberty. Open every day between October 26th and November 3rd with little to no wait. Drive over or catch a Move Sullivan bus, which stops at each location every weekday. Hours of operation at sullivan.us or by calling 845-807-0400. Paid for by Sullivan County Government.
Hey, it's Kai. On Notes from America, your voices are so important to what we do, how we tell stories, and how we create community around the show. And you're important in another way, as part of the community of Radio Catskill, which is able to bring you the shows you love with support from listeners like you. A pledge to Radio Catskill turns dollars into programs you enjoy. Now that is how community comes together.
Make your donation now at wjffradio.org.
The Fall Farm Drive is underway. Donate right now at wjffradio.org to help us continue to bring you and others this service. I'm Tim Bruno, and you're listening to Radio Catskill. New York Attorney General Letitia James has filed a lawsuit against River Valley Estates, a mobile home park in Sullivan County, citing years of hazardous living conditions and illegal rent increases. That's one of the stories that we spoke to the Times Union's Philip Pantuso about. Here's Jason Dole talking to Philip.
The Attorney General's office has filed a lawsuit against River Valley Estates, which is a mobile home park in Loch Sheldrake, alleging basically that the operators of the park, which are a couple named George Levin and Gayla Sue Levin, have for years failed to maintain essential infrastructure that has left hundreds of residents without clean water, and that they've charged illegal fees and illegally hiked rents that have cost tenants there hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's a pretty complicated lawsuit, but it's laying out a pretty wide range of allegations related to water outages, polluted water, other unsafe conditions, and these illegal fees and rent increases that the Attorney General is alleging have been passed on to tenants at this facility. The Attorney General is seeking a court order that would force River Valley to make all the repairs necessary to improve conditions at the mobile home park, pay $2.3 million in restitution to tenants, specifically for their lack of clean water service and illegal charges, and pay up to $295,000 in penalties to the state.
For the listeners, I'll let them know this is River Valley Estates. I think this is the former Foxcroft village there. It's on the Divine Corners Road, just below the Neversink Reservoir Dam, again, between Loch Sheldrake and Neversink on the back roads there. So
there's a lot to dig into. It, you know, it seems like this facility has faced allegations of poor treatment of renters in the past. There have been various other lawsuits, and the owners, at least George Levin, have been entangled in other illegal activities, including being accused of participating in a Ponzi scheme. So there's a lot to sort of unpack, and you know, you can read more on timesunion.com.
In another story, I know that you're following the even year election law. Sounds like that's not going to be happening. This is a proposal to kind of keep all the state elections on even years. Could you just explain to people what that was real quick, and then what's the latest development?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was introduced by State Senator James Skuthis and was passed into law in December, that would move local elections to even years so that they would align with races for governor, president, and Congress, which tend to bring a higher voter turnout. So, you know, to my personal great annoyance as an editor who covers multiple counties, counties do not always hold their elections at the same time. And there are a number of counties, particularly in the Hudson Valley, that have their local elections in odd years, right? So you're voting for county legislators, county executive, judges, et cetera, in different years than you would be voting for, let's say, the governor or your congressional representative. And so this law would basically force all of those counties who hold elections in odd years to move them to even years. As I said, it was signed into law in December, and it was championed by a lot of Democrats in the state legislature, though it has faced a lot of criticism, particularly on the local level and particularly from Republicans, not the least of which because it's just a huge logistical hurdle to change the election infrastructure. But basically, the long and short of it is that Democrats have said the law was intended to prevent voter confusion and to support increasing voter turnout, while opponents have said that this is sort of a fig leaf to increase voter turnout for Democrats specifically, because, you know, basically Democrats tend to vote at higher rates in even year elections just because there's a strong correlation between overall voter turnout and Democratic turnout specifically.
Okay. I knew there was a political angle somewhere in this, and that was something that I was overlooking. I mean, there's the sticking point.
Yeah. So that's kind of like that describes sort of the tenor of the debate around this issue. Like it has been pretty partisan. The Senate Minority Leader, Rob Ort, called it back in December when it was signed into law, a total sham, and that it was concocted to, quote, hide the Democrats' goal of expanding one-party control to every level of government, which is pretty strong. But setting aside any, you know, perceived or alleged political motivations for the law change, there are legitimate apolitical criticisms here. And what happened is that there was a challenge that was brought by a group of voters, several towns, and Republican county executives from a range of counties, Onondaga, Rockland, Orange, Dutchess, Rensselaer, Nassau, and Oneida counties. Those counties are all run by Republican county execs, and they all hold their elections in odd years. All of those lawsuits were consolidated into one case that was heard at the state Supreme Court, and a ruling was issued on Tuesday at a state Supreme Court in Onondaga County that struck down the even year election law. And the judge who issued the ruling, his name is Gerard Neri. He gave a few reasons for striking this down. One he noted is that, there's a lot of case law, including decisions by the Court of Appeals, which is New York's highest court, and opinions from the state attorney general and the Bill of Rights for Local Government that is enshrined in the state constitution that support the plaintiff's argument in this case that counties have the authority to adopt, amend, or repeal alternative forms of county government. The judge also made what I found to be a pretty compelling argument, frankly, which is that the even year election law would functionally double the size of a voter's ballot and could lead to voter confusion and a drop off in voter participation in down ballot races and referendums. So basically, there's already a pretty significant drop off for down ballot races, because if you go to the polls and you're voting, let's say, on president you'll vote for your Senate member, maybe you'll vote for your congressional member. You may not get to town proposition 3 related to funding for the library at the very bottom or on the back of your ballot. And if all of these places that hold their local elections in odd years were to move them to even years, it's going to make everybody's ballot much bigger, and it's going to put all of these local and hyper-local votes, both races and anything else that's subject to election, on the same ballot, and thus kind of competing against state and national issues. And that could mean that there's fewer votes cast for those things that are further down the ballot. He cited an example in a 2022 gubernatorial race in the town of DeWitt, where in that election, 68 people did not vote for the governor's race at the top of the ticket. And on the same ballot at the bottom of the ticket, 780 voters did not vote for a ballot proposition that would change the term of the highway supervisor. So that's a huge drop off, basically, from the top to the bottom. And it, you know, I don't think that can be entirely explained by people just having stronger opinions about who's the mayor versus, or I'm sorry, who's the governor versus who or what the term of the highway supervisor could be.
That's something that I did not consider. That is a really interesting point, and it makes me think of then a couple others, because if the ballot then is so expanded, you know, turnout. I'm a pro voting person, so I want there to be good turnout. We don't really have a lot of people in a lot of rural areas, but in some places, having that many more people turn out, that might physically be a problem at polling places. Just one of other logistical issues that seem to be at the heart of the apolitical objections to this. But a little more broader and perhaps philosophically, you know, the old saw for both press and elected officials used to be all politics is local, meaning you could get away from a lot of the party divisions at, you know, the state or most likely the national level when you have to work at the county, village, town level. And with all of those things on the ballot, yeah, they might not even get to the hyper-local stuff with so much big stuff on the top. But I feel like there's been an erosion of that notion of all politics is local. And this is something that might further erode that.
It's hard to say exactly. You know, what the judge wrote was he actually used it in his decision. He used another old journalism term that I found notable, at least. He said, to use an obsolete term, there are only so many column inches the news can and will handle. By maintaining a separation of even year federal and state elections and odd year local elections, local interests would not have to compete for attention with more widely covered state and national issues.
Finally, you got to tour the Food Bank of Hudson Valley's new distribution facility in Montgomery. What was that like?
Yeah, so Lana Bellamy, our sort of lower Hudson Valley reporter, went out there. This is a new distribution facility that is being built in the town of Montgomery for the Food Bank of the Hudson Valley, which services like from the lower Hudson Valley all the way up into the capital region. This food bank is for the 6 southernmost counties in that territory, which includes Sullivan, Ulster, Dutchess, Orange, Rockland, and Putnam counties. The food bank serves about 150,000 people in that area by a network of some 400 partner agencies. It distributes about 20 million pounds of food a year. So for years, the food bank, the lower Hudson Valley anyway, distribution center in Cornwall, that's where they've been based. And we reported last year that that facility can't accommodate the growing demand to provide food for those in need of Hudson Valley in the Hudson Valley. We've done a lot of reporting basically on you know, rising hunger here in the Hudson Valley. So the food bank basically embarked on building a much bigger facility with the help of a community development block grant. It is scheduled to open in January, but but they're still looking for a lot of volunteers. And that's, you know, Lana's story basically kind of gets into what they're looking for, what kind of the new capacity that the food bank will have. And it also kind of touches on the growing need for food, really, in the Hudson Valley that the food bank is trying to address.
Yeah, putting another spotlight on the continuing food insecurity in our region. That story is up now at timesunion.com, along with all these other stories, along with the follow-up stories that will be coming for some of these stories that you're following. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, managing editor for Hudson Valley at Times Union at timesunion.com. Thank you so much, Philip.
You got it. Take care.
And thanks to Jason Dole for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a local effort by some 4-H students here in Hortonville, New York, who are trying to fill a truck to send to the western part of North Carolina to help with hurricane relief. We'll talk to them next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, I'm Jason Tuga of The Mixtape. I'm able to produce my show every Friday night because of listeners like you. While Radio Catskill receives revenue from other sources, like grants and events, listeners are the largest and most reliable piece of the pie. That's why we need your support during our fall fund drive. Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
It's our fall fund drive underway. Donate now to help us bring you local news, culture, and NPR. Including this next story. You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And the next story is from our friends at Small Town Country 4-H. They're in Hortonville, New York, a 4-H program that has decided that they need to help out some folks who need some help. Folks who have been wrecked by Hurricane Helene in western North Carolina. They are doing a fill the truck drive. And I've got four of the members of Small Town Country 4-H here in the studio live. Why don't you guys let us know your names? I'm going to go start with you. What's your name?
My name is Maylee Phelps, and I am the club president this year.
My name is Adeline Johnson, and I am the news reporter.
Okay, guys, and you are? Yep, you're up.
Abigail Ferber.
Okay.
And I'm Alice Ferber.
All right. Thank you guys for coming in. Tell us a little bit about, as the president of the Small Town Country 4-H, why you guys decided to do this. You probably saw all the news reports and decided, well, we got to do something, right?
Yeah, we saw all of the news reports, and we thought it would be a good community service project to help out for all the people that are struggling right now.
Yeah, and that's what you guys do as part of 4-H, too. You have community projects, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about this Fill the Truck initiative. How did it come about? Who's helping you out?
So we have Kay's Trucking helping us out, and they are donating a truck to drive down there, and we are filling it with all sorts of goods.
You're not going to? No? Okay, tell us more about what kind of goods folks can donate. What things are you looking for? Alice, go ahead.
We are looking for items to fill the truck, like water, non-perishable foods, sports drinks, diapers, baby wipes, socks, sanitizer wipes, trash bags, candles, toothpaste, toothbrushes, baby formula, hand sanitizer.
Okay. Anything else?
Venomin, hydrogen peroxide, plastic utensils, pet food, cleaning supplies, lighters, and tarps.
That's great, Ed. So where can folks bring this stuff? Where is the Kay's truck located for folks who want to help out?
The Kay's truck is located at the Hortonville Firehouse Department.
Okay. And folks could come. When can they come? Is it just this one day that's coming up on Sunday? Is that right?
They can come the 20th.
So that's this Sunday, the 20th. And you guys are also doing a 5K race on that day. So what's the timing like for these two events? When can folks kind of start coming on Sunday to donate? And then when can they come for the race?
They can come at 10 a, at 9 a.m.
9 a.m. to donate? And then when does the race start?
9 a.m.
Okay, so you've got those two things. Mom, do you want to jump in?
Sure. So the race is going to step off at 9, and then in order to keep our racers safe, they should be off the race course around 11. And then if folks want to bring their donation items from 11 o'clock on, we'll be there until the truck is full. So anytime after 11, or if you did want to participate in the race, you can come as early as 7 a.m. for same day registration. And if you want to pre-register, you can do that online now through Run Sign Up, or you can find more details on our Facebook page.
And you're going to fill the truck. You're going to accept donations until the truck is full. So you're hoping to fill this truck. How big is this truck?
This is a 48-foot tractor trailer.
All right. You got a tractor trailer to fill. So folks definitely need that help. Have you gotten some good feedback so far from this initiative from the young women here representing the 4-H Club?
We sure have. The kids have put together collection boxes at various locations. You might see them around the community. I know some of the school groups have also started to collect. Other 4-H clubs are jumping in and collecting. PEX Markets has been super generous and donated a couple truckloads of non-perishable food items. We've gotten some cases of water donated already. We've also gotten a lot of hay donations from the local farmers. So the truck already is about half full with square bales ready to go down and help out these other 4-H kids.
That's awesome. So what do you think as a proud mom seeing not only your daughter but these young women doing such a great thing for their community service to help others?
It's really exciting. When we had talked about this initiative, the emotion in our 4-H meeting, it was like electric. Hearing the kids say, well, we could do this, we could do that. It was really exciting to see how each child was trying to take these ideas and incorporate, how could I bring more things to help fill this truck, and how am I going to make this work? And just the excitement alone is like spreading like wildfire through
That's
the community.
Great. That's so great. And for folks who may not know, Hortonville is a small hamlet here in Sullivan County, but with a big heart. And you guys have a really big heart to do this. And we're going to fill that truck, right? Okay. Anything else you want us to know before we go? It's your last chance. We haven't heard from the littlest Ferber. No? Nothing? All right. Anything else you want to add, Madam President? Where can folks get more information?
They can get more information online on our Facebook at Small Town Country 4-H.
Well, great. You guys, what a great thing that you're doing, and you're making us all proud here. So if you listeners, you can, again, help fill this truck. They're sending it down to folks in need who were slammed by that Hurricane Helene in the western part of North Carolina and the Carolinas is what I'm trying to say. So help out and, you know, support the good efforts that these guys are doing. Guys, thanks so much. You did a great job. It wasn't so bad. No.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and we'll be back with more Radio Chatskill.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And if everybody actually paid, public radio would be swimming in money. But of course, public radio is free. That's important, that it's free for everybody. If and when you decide to donate, you're keeping this radio station on the air for the whole community. All of us who make these shows just want them to be out there for everyone. It's your donation that makes that possible. Here's how to pledge.
Keep Radio Catskill freely available to the entire community. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Matt Hurtado from Virtual Soundscapes, the video game music show only on Radio Catskill. In celebration of Halloween, join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m. this month for spooky video game music and exclusive interviews with the developers of Cryptmaster, Dead by Daylight, Puppet Master, and The Mortuary Assistant. That's every Thursday at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Round the Bend Theater is presenting a reading of a new play called Canosa Lake by Margie Simeloff. It's today in Rosendale, New York. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to the playwright.
Good morning, Margie, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning, Valerie. Thank you for having me.
We were very excited here at the radio station to see that you have written a play about Canosa Lake, which is a couple of miles away from where I sit. So tell us about your play.
Sure, I'd love to. It's actually, I would say that Canosa Lake is really a metaphor mm-hmm. for an idyllic place. A pretty hamlet where people spent their summers and have powerful childhood memories. But the story is fiction. It's not some biography of anything that actually happened in Canosa mm-hmm. Lake. And my dad's family had a bungalow there, and that would have been probably in the 1930s and into the 1940s, into the late 1940s. And it was super important to the family, as obviously so many other families that spent summers there, came up from the city. And for them, of course, for a little boy, it was all about getting out of the city and going fishing, getting all that great country fresh air.
Oh, yes.
And I used Canosa Lake because he had such good memories. And I've been there many times. I've driven through. And I've actually sat with him in the car looking out at the lake. And I could see his mind going as he was remembering all of the things that used to happen in that town. Right at that little intersection we sat, just looking south toward the lake. But the story itself is really about culture change and about intolerance and about people focusing on their own interests and people that are apathetic or indifferent to what's going on around them. That's what I'm really looking at. It just happens to take place in an idyllic town.
And this is a contemporary time setting?
So it's both, actually. There are parallel stories. One of the stories takes place in 1960, and the other story takes place in modern times. But they're connected by one man who was a teenager in 1960, and he left the town because of a traumatic event, and then he returns for one last look. He's older now. He's around 80, and actually he is 80, and he returns for one last look at the lake that he loved so much because he hears the lake singing to him. It's in his head.
Oh, how beautiful.
And he's remembering what happened there then on that night. And in the current day, he sees some of the same behaviors that happened a long time ago, intolerance and basically apathy and indifference. That's really what I'm focusing on. People who are willing to tolerate antisocial behavior as long as they're not the ones being inconvenienced. And I feel like he tries to call it out to the young people that surround him when he's in the bar and in the current day, and they're just busy living their lives. And the question is, does this continue on and on through the generations, or does somebody stand up and do something about it?
And this is about cultural changes that are taking place?
It's about the many cultural changes that are taking place during the times. I think, and the people who want to push for cultural change and the people that want to resist cultural change. And like every town, there's a hierarchy, and there's always tension between the outsiders and the insiders, the locals versus the people that are coming from away. And to me, it felt like that the issues back in 1960, for example, since I picked that year, seemed very simple compared with the issues that we face today, but also to me, the stakes feel just as high. And I'm sure in those years, it felt just as apocalyptic to the people that were living it. There's always outsiders and there's always insiders and there's always people that feel like they have ownership. I don't think it's possible to shake that, but I like to think that we can all get along.
Well, I'm with you on that one. We want our listeners to know where and when this is happening. Monday the 14th at 7 in Hunter, New York. And before we go, let me ask you, are you a full-time playwright or part-time?
Full-time now. I was a journalist. I recently gave up my day job about 2 years ago. I was writing about technology for people that buy technology. And I have been playwriting for about 10 years, I think, about that. Now that I'm no longer working a day job.
And there is more information at roundthebenchtheater.org. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us.
Thanks, Valerie.
And thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Faith Kelly and Kasmin Moon are just a couple of wanderers, two solo artists who traveled together from the Catskills of New York to share their songs to anyone, anywhere, they say. And this Saturday, they'll be at the Sullivan County Diversity and Youth Committee's Sullivan Rock the Vote concert. It's Saturday, and they're both here on a holiday to say hi and tell us more about it. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Tell us more about this event, this Rock the Vote concert, an effort to just get out the vote, right?
Yeah. So our friend Myrna reached out to us a few weeks ago and was like, hey, you want to come play Sullivan Rock the Vote at New Memories, which is just a really, really cool venue. Art everywhere, ran by really wonderful friends of ours. And there's just a handful of people playing that are really good friends of ours. It's a $10 suggested donation. And it's all about getting out the vote. It's a nonpartisan event. So anyone is welcome to just come on out and just kind of celebrate music and what we can do together.
Yeah. I'm pretty excited because a lot of the people playing, we got, you know, Cowabunga Boys. Those are new for me.
Yeah.
But my friend Eamon, Mike Brown, CRISPR's going to be there.
Yes.
CRISPR
and the cameraman. I haven't gotten to see the cameraman live yet, so I'm really stoked for that.
Greg Richard. Castro, Kathy Geary. Yeah, your own Kathy Geary.
We know that name. We know a lot of these names. We know you guys as well. And, yeah. You know, great that you guys are behind this. Why is it important for you, you know, to make sure folks do register and vote?
Well, because it's something we get to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's the most important thing.
It's pretty cool that we can do it, you know?
Not a lot of people can do that sometimes around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And will there be registration available for folks there? Or
I am not 100% sure, but I feel like there is at least there will be people there representing too.
Yeah, yes. I think what it's more about is raising the awareness to actually go out and vote.
Yeah.
I will remind folks who might be on the road, like we'll be in Austin, Texas on Election Day. Now is the time to send in for the absentee ballot.
Yeah, and be sure to check your local Board of Elections. Of course, we have listeners in two states, and the Pennsylvania rules are slightly different from the New York rules in terms of early voting, mail-in ballots, absentee ballots.
Oh, yeah.
But we all know Election Day is November 5th, and we all know that we have this power to vote and choose our destinies here in America, so do that. Rock the vote.
It's a good exercise, you know? If we get to do it, why not do it?
Are you going to play a little bit for us this morning?
Yeah, I'm going to play a song from my first album called We Dream. So I guess just go for it.
Yeah, let's hear it. This is Faith Kelly playing for us this morning.
Just going to adjust my headphone. All right. There is hope when there is no hope. There is hope when there is no hope. That we dream. That we dream. That we dream. That we dream. There is love when there is no love. There is love when there is no love. That we dream. That we dream. That we dream. That we dream. There
found faith. There is faith when there is now faith that we dream. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream. There is peace when there is no peace. Hear it again. There is peace when there is no peace. Shall we dream? Yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, yeah, we dream. There is more when there is no more. There is more when there is no more. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream. Yeah, yeah, we dream. Yeah, we dream.
Faith Kelly live in the studio here with Kasmyn Moon, and both of them will be performing at the Sullivan County Diversity and Youth Committee's Sullivan Rock the Vote concert. It's this Saturday from noon until 6 at New Memories in Parksville, New York. There's more information via email, diversityandyouth@gmail.com. Again, the Rock the Vote concert with Faith and Kasmyn and a host of other folks. Kasmyn, you want to run those down
I'll ramble through them really quick. Hey, what's up, Marcus? What's up, Bryson? What's up, James? Thanks for building new memories for us all. Yeah. Featuring bands, Cowabunga Boys, Eamon LeBeau, Mike Brown, Faith Kelly and Kasmyn Moon, CRISPR. Woo! Cameraman Greg Castro, Kathy Geary, your own Kathy Geary, Ruby on the Vine, and Richard Travis.
Yes.
So that's a heck of a show.
That's a lot of my favorite
bands.
That's
a solid lineup for Rockin' the Vote.
Definitely.
That's Saturday again at New Memories in Parksville. Faith and Kasmyn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, and you can find more information about the election, all of our election coverage at our website, wjffradio.org. And also in that page, on that election page, there's a candidate guide with candidates who are running in the multiple races across the two states. And there's also Vote 411 brought to us by the League of Women Voters, election information you need. You can figure out how to check your registration and find out what's on your ballot. All of that available to keep you connected this election season on our website, WJFFradio.org. Hey, while you're there, donate to our fall fund drive. Thanks. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskills Fall Fun Drive is happening now. At a time when less than half of American households donate to nonprofits, we get it. Budgets are tight and there's a lot going on. But that's why if you're able to give, it's so important right now. Your gift is an investment that keeps the community engaged and informed. It gives you and yours the information you need. So make that investment now for everyone who needs it. Donate at wjffradio.org.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskills Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskills. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, a couple of showers, high 51, windy as well. Tonight, low 36, and tomorrow, a little chillier even, high of only 46, afternoon shower expected as well. Tomorrow night's low 36 and only 43 for Wednesday. It's 11 o'clock.